All right, this is just a section of the introduction. The introduction is actually quite a bit longer. We'll have the books for you next time. You can read them at your leisure. What you probably notice right away in terms of the framework, how Paul's approaching this is a law-gospel, quite evidently a law-gospel paradigm here that he's working with. Were any of you familiar with Diogenes behaving badly at the Olympic Games? Yeah. And I like the way he brought that in there because he wants to make the point, this is not cynicism. So when we talk like this, we're not just being negative for the sake of being cynics. You know, not really sure why Diogenes did what he did, but anyway, that's not what we're up to as Lutherans. When we talk about, in the very first sentences, he said, Lutherans are about mounting a full frontal assault, not on the worst in life, but on the best in life. That is shocking to most people, including a lot of Lutherans. And what you have to do to get over that shock is to recognize what this is not is a statement of cynicism about, well, life's terrible, it's just all, you know, live fast and die young, or, you know, go out and commit suicide, or whatever it might be, you know. That's not what we're talking about here, and certainly what Paulson is not talking about here. But as you've read through this first brief section here, what is he talking about? What is he saying that Lutheran message in this first respect is designed to do? He says it down here in the lower part of the first page. The first task of theology, and when you read the word theology, it's down there right toward the bottom. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines up or so. When he says the first task of theology, the word theology can also mean the first task of preaching or the first task of the witness to the Christian faith. Any of the expository elements of the faith that we witness with and to, the first task is to witness to sin and make it great, so great that it kills. If this is lost, then there is no way to avoid a religion of cooperation with God. If any of the old sinner is left standing after the proclamation, then all you have is Moses saying, okay, God's done this, now you do this. Here's the little bit left that you can do to make this work. And what Paulson wants us to understand right off the bat is, and this is why it's been such a struggle for Lutheranism, not to mention the rest of the Christian church, since the 16th century, what he wants to say right off the bat is precisely what Luther said, and that is, it is our righteousness that has to die, not our sinfulness, because our righteousness also is sinful. Now, where does that leave us, you see? Where does that leave us?
Without anything.
Without anything. Exactly. Yeah, it's like, and at the end of Romans, I think it's Romans 3:20, St. Paul says, God has done all this so that every mouth will be stopped and silenced and every person be held accountable to God. There is no there's no loophole for me to get out from underneath this with. It's total. Now, this obviously carries with it some difficulties. And one of the things we want to talk about as we go along here, we can start for a few minutes today, what are some of the difficulties that we encounter with approaching the faith this way? What are some difficulties we might encounter?
Constant rebuttal, even within the Christian church, that this is not a proper message. That there's still left, like you were mentioning in your sermon today, it's the free will. I've got to exercise my free will to seal the deal, to make a partnership with God, and make this whole thing enterprise work.
Precisely, yes. And what Luther recognized, as Gerhard Fürthe did, and many others, and Steve Paulson certainly. Steve Paulson, by the way, is in the chair that Gerhard Fürthe held at Luther Seminary. So he's in that tradition of Lutheran theologians. What Luther recognized, though, going back to the 16th century, was that you know that you're onto something when you preach this because the attack always comes in defense of free will. That's always the reaction, isn't it? Wait a minute, I'm free. I'm free to make my own decision. And Luther says that's exactly what you want to see. That's the objection you want to see. That's the old sinner staking out his or her ground against the Word of God, against the absolute promise. See, I have to do something. And you notice that it's always a negative. I mean, the real negative is not, as Steve Paulson is trying to point out here, the real negative is not saying that Lutheranism is an assault on righteousness, because it goes on to say, so that Christ may be like, hooray, everything. The real negative is seen in the reaction to this. Going to fight. Going to fight bondage of the will. Going to fight infant baptism. Going to fight Lord's Supper as the sacrament of God. I'm going to fight grace. You see, that, Luther said, there it is. There's the proof in the pudding that this message is not from us. It has to be a completely alien word that affects a real change in us. A real change in us. I mean, how many of you have felt, I'd be curious, how many of you have felt over the years, who have gone through periods in your Christian life, when you really believe that the Christian life is a cooperative effort between God and myself? God does his part, I do my part. It's reasonable, isn't it? Yeah, it makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah. Quid pro quo, this for that, right?
Everything else works that way.
Everything else in life works that way, right? That's how we establish what Paulson would call, what Luther would call, human righteousness. How do I demonstrate that I am righteous before you? Well, we have certain requirements. And if I meet those requirements, whatever they might be, as we've decided what they are, then I establish myself as righteous or good. Use that word, good. And if we all agree on what good is, then we can decide, well, some are good and some aren't, right? Some are righteous and some are not righteous. And at least judging on externals, then we can operate the world that way. And that's what, in the next section, we'll get to that next week, but that's what Stephen Paulson calls the legal scheme. The legal scheme by which we actually operate in life. Well, what the gospel brings, Paulson's going to show us in this book, the gospel is an alien righteousness. That's the word that Luther also liked. It's a righteousness that does not fit the legal scheme. It doesn't play that game. It's a righteousness that's established from outside of the legal scheme, the sinful scheme, and it is simply given. It's handed over without any expectation. Now, this is a real shock, isn't it? Because what if I consider myself to be a really religious and spiritual person and I work hard at it? You know, I go to church. Whenever the door opens, I fall in, you know. I'm leaning in it, ready to go. I'm a project. I pray all the time. I read religious books and I do all kinds of things to try to show how faithful I am and how devoted I am, and I expect that God's going to reward me for that in some way. There's going to be some way in which that kind of righteousness is rewarded by God. There's a kind of quid pro quo, this for that, where that's concerned. What the Lutheran message says is, no. No. Let's not even worry about all the bad things you think, say, and do that nobody else really knows about, just except you, because you keep it so well hidden, nobody ever sees it. We won't try to dig all that up and, you know, throw that in your face. Luther says, let's just cut right to the chase, okay? Let's look at all the wonderful things you think you're doing for Christ and let's say, forget it. That accounts for nothing. It's just as bad to lean on those things for some kind of righteousness' sake as it is to try to turn away from all those things you wouldn't dare utter in the light of day. Both are in the same camp. Now, if this is the predicament, okay, then what might one require in this state? A savior. Funny thing! If I'm simply stuck, you know, I got gum on my shoe, and I can't I really want to do the right thing, but I can't get my shoe unstuck from the ground. What do I need? I need a maintenance man, or I need somebody to come along and sort of give me a little boost, a little help. And I need somebody to kind of pry it loose so I can get on with what I really want to do. And this, Paulson argues, and Luther argued, and certainly I've argued for years, and other pastors in this camp have argued, that's precisely what much of the Christian church is engaged in. That the Christian life, and this is the last line in the first opening section here, the faulty assumption of much of the faith has been that the Christian life is a move from vice to virtue. To move away from being a bad person toward being a good person. Which in certain compartments of life is a fine idea that no one should object to, right? But when it comes to faith, and when it comes to the relationship with God, Luther argues, it is not a move from vice to virtue. It's a move away from virtue to grace, the grace of Christ. It's recognizing that neither vice nor virtue are the issue. And this is where the church is mired continually. Yes, Brent.
Luther's quote was, abandon good and evil, cling to Christ.
Yes, abandon good and evil. That was, you hear that kind of stuff and you just, you want to, you see. Why? Because we hear it as participants and practitioners of the legal scheme, the vice to virtue scheme. And when somebody says abandon good and evil or sin boldly, but believe more boldly still, like another quote of Luther, it's like hearing fingernails on a blackboard. You know, what? Are you saying I should just abandon goodness and stop trying to be a decent person and embrace evil? Well, no, that's not what that says. It says abandon good and evil in the sense that abandon the whole transactional relationship with God. As if by doing more good, you're going to get in better with God, and by doing more evil, you're going to get in worse with God. You're already as in bad with God as you can get. You're a sinner. Okay? It doesn't get any worse than that. You're tainted. Well, I'm tainted. We're all tainted. So it isn't that we can somehow improve our status by dusting ourselves off and make sure our shirts are pressed before we go out the door in the morning. You see, it's a sickness unto death. And so to claim free will, which Paulson will talk quite profoundly about here in this book, to claim that I have some capacity to choose the good where God is concerned, that God will somehow respond positively for, is in fact blasphemy. Because to claim you can set yourself free from this sickness unto death is to claim a power that you don't have. Only God has. That's the heart of it right there. So when you hear the preacher get up and say, Jesus died for you, which is great, you know, went to the cross, shed his blood, but now you must accept him into your heart to be saved, that is blasphemy. The preacher is telling you, you have a power you do not have, that only God has. And that's why it's so insidious and so damaging and so serious, you see. Because you start with the cross in that kind of message, and where do you end? With you. He died, but now you must choose. Well, which is it? Well, his death made it possible for you to choose, you see. So we do all kinds of things to try to make it fit into the pre-existing scheme of moving from bad to good, the legal structure, you see. And what Luther understood in reading Paul in Romans, and this is where Steve Paulson is going to really unload all this for us, Luther understood in reading Romans was Paul did not employ the legal scheme to make Christians, he obliterated it. He destroyed it. He put an end to it. So that all that was left for the Christian was Christ. And of course, the old sinner in us who just refuses to die, you know, won't go down without a fight, immediately objects, right? Well, does that mean that all the good that I do doesn't matter? Yes and no. Where your neighbor is concerned, it matters. You know? Where God is concerned, no, doesn't matter. Yeah.
Is an underlying voice saying, this is a man's, a woman's attempt always to be God themselves?
Yeah.
Always reaching up, always trying to somehow transplant God and make themselves God?
Yeah, that's the core problem, you know. I mean, American society, with all of its virtues, you know, has basically made human willfulness into the highest value.
Yeah, right.
That's really what you see going on here, yeah. You know. I think I may have mentioned last week when Linda and I were in the cruise recently to Hawaii, we were talking to one of the crew members, and he was saying that one of the cruise lines tried an experiment. Didn't go too well, but they tried it. If you've been on a cruise, you notice that almost none of the crew are Americans, young people. Almost none of them. They're from the Philippines or from Eastern Europe. So this company, trying to be, well, let's employ some American kids, they staffed this boat with American young people. They got to Hawaii and 30% of them mutinied. Stayed in Hawaii when the ship left. Because they didn't like the hours. They didn't like being told what to do. They were rude to the passengers. This is the kind of people we create here. So if you're going to hire people to serve in American society, where do they have to come from? Mexico? South America? Central America? Philippines? But do you think that a lot of our American young people would sully themselves by taking a menial job if they could avoid it, you see? Well, this is to Duane's point. To look at this theologically as Christians, what we see going here, this is human willfulness being fanned, you know. It's the flame being fanned, you see. That's what American society, in one sense, has done. It's created freedom. Of course, there is no freedom outside of God, so it's not real freedom. It's a sham freedom in many respects. And that freedom will set loose both good and evil, vice and virtue. So you're going to have to deal with both. And so we are probably the most litigious society in history, because the more you set people free, the more... what? The more they sin, the more laws they break. Now, over in parts of Europe and other parts of the world, corruption is so endemic, it's just taken as a way of life. You know, they don't go to court every 5 minutes. They don't have lawyers in every corner. It's just, well, you know, I'll pay under the table and, you know, and everything works fine, right? I mean, you don't have to worry about going to court every 5 minutes because everybody's corrupt and they just engage in the system. Well, over here, we try to maintain this kind of Calvinist ideal, you know, work ethic, no free lunch, nobody gets away with anything, and so we got lawyers coming out of our ears. Well, again, theologically, it's not surprising, you see, because you have a country of people who, to some extent, are just running amok. Their free wills are doing what free wills do. You want to see what free will gets you? Take a look, you know. One more quote, and then we'll quit for today. Is not my striving toward the good the very best thing about me? No. No, the one thing outside that must be planted is Jesus Christ, the God who is a man. No righteousness that comes from us, from our doings or our heart, will endure before God. Only Christ's righteousness lives in the future. This is a really interesting statement. Only Christ's righteousness lives in the future, which is a way of saying that as a Christian, you know that as you move into the immediate future and as you contemplate the farther future, what are you meeting as you move forward? You're only meeting Christ and the one who has forgiven your sins. So you're moving into the forgiveness of sins. You're not running from something. You're being washed in it constantly. It's just bathing you as you move into the future. You see, that's what that means. There is nothing to worry about. You see, I can tell by the looks in some of your faces, you're still not so sure. But it's all right. That's why you have to keep listening to the preacher. Hopefully you'll get it beat out of you eventually. This righteousness from the future, which is utterly external and foreign to us, we must become other, foreign to ourselves in the one person of the Jew, Jesus, who was crucified. So that with Paul we can say, it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives. The life I live in the flesh, I now live by faith in the Son of God who gave himself for me. The flesh is nothing. This human body, where God is concerned as an offering of righteousness, is no longer of any value. Now, this only matters if you really are taking God with any seriousness. And that's why it doesn't matter very much today in so many corners. And as I said in my sermon, if you're in the business of trying to establish your own spirituality and righteousness before God, and you take God with any sincerity, what happens is uncertainty starts to gnaw away. Am I really doing enough? What about what I pulled 10 years ago? Nobody else knows about it, but I still do, and it just eats away at me. Or what about the things that I've left undone? I walked away from, I walked around, I didn't want to deal with it. And so my uncertainty now becomes the uncertain God. Am I really going to meet a gracious God when I die? Or is he going to slap me on the bench and drag out the attorneys and start laying the evidence in front of me? How do I know? I mean, I know that I want to have a gracious God. But how do I know I have a gracious God? Not just wishfully thinking I have a gracious God, but how do I actually know that I have a gracious God? Not hoping I do. A God who will receive me as I am, as a sinner, not as somebody who tries to, you know, hold up some kind of pretense of righteousness, but who will just take me naked and ashamed as he took Jesus. See, how do I know that's the kind of God that I'm going to meet? And this is what the Lutheran message wants to give to people. Here's how you can know. And one of the answers that we will discuss in some detail in the book was in the sermon this morning. Baptism. I mean, it actually happened in your life, right? It was real water, and real words were spoken into that water. In the name of the Father and of the Son, it was an adoption ceremony, what it was, you know. Did that happen to you? Then you know. You can know, you see? You can know that the divine graciousness of God has touched you, has taken hold of you. That's what we mean when we talk about baptism. It's not a religious symbol. It's an event of adoption. You know, that gal in the Paralympics, what's her name? She was adopted from a Russian orphanage, and she recently went back. They had a program on it on TV yesterday. Jessica somebody.
Long?
Yeah, Jessica Long, adopted in a Russian orphanage. And she's become this gold medalist Paralympian, you know, swimming, famous, you know. And she went back with her sister to meet her parents. Her actual parents actually got married and have kids. So, I mean, she met her family of origin, you see. Well, and then the lady who gave her to her adoptive father in the orphanage years and years ago was still working at the orphanage. Well, I sat there and watched that and said, that's exactly what happens in baptism. You are handed over to Christ, you see. You belong to him now. It happened in actual time and place. And if you back away from that even a little, what do you wind up doing? You spiritualize it, right? Now it becomes kind of a symbol of somebody's good intentions. My parents, the pastor, the church, but not mine because I couldn't choose. you see. But if God's the one who is choosing, the one who can't choose, or won't choose, or doesn't know how to choose, then my not choosing or not knowing how to choose or not wanting to choose becomes irrelevant, because the one who can choose is the one who actually can, who has the authority to make that decision. And that's why it's such a wonderful thing to be able to return to baptism and bring nothing with you of the old self, only the promise of Christ, you see. And the final anecdote, which you've heard before, Luther was being held at the Wartburg Castle during 9 months. He was being hidden by the Elector of Saxony, hidden from the papal armies and forces, trying to arrest him and kill him. And of course, he's in this largely untenanted castle, just a few people around, a couple of knights to guard him and a few people to, you know, do the laundry and cook the meals, that kind of thing. Otherwise, he's by himself, and you're in the Thuringian forest there in southeast Germany, and, you know, the nights are long, and things are kind of scary. It's 16th century. People think there are spooks everywhere anyway. And Luther starts to hear doubts in his head. He starts to hear all kinds of voices saying, you know, who are you, Martin? All these Christians in Europe, the Christendom, all over the Catholic world, and you alone? No? You see? So the doubts just kind of piled in on him. So he took a piece of chalk and he went over to the wall and he wrote, I am baptized. Not as an appeal to some kind of magic or a rabbit's foot, you know, or wishful thinking, but as a reminder of what the gospel is. It's the word from outside that silences all doubts from within. Yes, you are a sinner. Yes, you have stirred up Catholic Europe. Yes, you have made a mess of things. People are mad at you from one end of the continent to the other. And you're responsible for that. But in Christ, it doesn't matter. Because it's all been done not for his sake, but for the sake of Christ, for the sake of the gospel. See, and when you start to get a handle on the radicality of this, then you can start to get a sense of what a powerful movement it was and can be again. And that's why we must hold the line for the sake of the church as well as for the sake of the world. You see, it's not just about, you know, a little club trying to maintain some kind of theological identity. This is about a faithful confessional stance based on what we truly believe the gospel of Jesus Christ is and what it is not. And when it's properly understood, then this alien righteousness that comes from outside of us, you see, then there are simply no conditions of our sinful life which have the right to witness against us. They have been crucified and buried with him. Now, you see, you might just call that good news. You see. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll give you the books next time. We'll do some more discussion about this, and then you can do some reading, and then we'll be able to be on the same page a little more. Okay, thanks. Have a good week.